Hello everyone, and welcome to This Nintendo Life, episode 253. My name is NBZ, and Bali, I refuse to bow down to what Musk has said and what he has done, and it changed on my phone now, and there's just a letter X there, and that, I think it's like almost the final straw with me. I don't know what to do. Are we abandoning Twitter? What's happening, Bali? How are you feeling about things?
I think initially I thought it was just like a stunt. You know, Musk loves a stunt. You know, he loves attention.
He's like, lol, if you vote in this poll, I won't be CEO anymore. And then everyone said, don't be CEO. And he's like, oh, that was a joke. he takes all these things very seriously.
Exactly. So I think that it just kind of feels like he likes the attention. I guess he has our attention from this exploit, but then it all seems and happens to be a hell of a lot more serious and is actually happening and changing. So, I just don't understand what's going on. Like, does Twitter even have a board anymore?
I don't think so. I think he fired literally everybody. Okay. I think is what happens.
Just
so,
that most companies, you got like a CEO and they're responsible to shareholders and their board.
Uh-huh.
And the board is trying to operate in the interest of shareholders. So while they don't dictate what's happening, they have a big say in like making sure things are on the right path. And to have a company as big as Twitter that is just, or X, that is just,
we're not doing that. We're not calling it X.
Which we're not going to do. It just feels weird. I mean, Twitter has a lot of faults, but one of the things I think that they nailed right from the start was the branding with the bird and tweeting. Uh-huh. Like the idea of a tweet and a microblog felt really innovative and new, and the blue theme and that bird, like it works. Like it's arguably one of the best things about Twitter. It's just a really distinctive look, and it's probably in the top 10, 20 most recognized logos in the world, I'd argue, and just to evaporate that overnight feels really bizarre.
I don't know if you saw the tweet going around talking about how when he was at PayPal, when, you know, he was fired from the company, it was because he tried to rebrand it as X.com. And so this is a long play for two decades from Elon Musk to call something X.com. And now he doesn't have anyone who can fire him anymore, so he can just do whatever the hell he wants. It's impacting me in a way that I didn't expect, in the sense of, like, I look at my favorite bar on my PC, like, all the time, every day, and same with my phone, of, like, the apps I go to, and there's, like...
Oh, MBZ's favorite is his favorite porn site. Like, it's
There was another tweet about that, where it's like five of these all X's, like in the bookmarks bar. It's like one of these is not a porn site.
Don't open the wrong one at work.
Jesus. It feels terrible, and like it, like my habitual nature of like clicking the blue icon every day is like it just turns me off. It just makes me not want to click it anymore, and I just don't know what to do, because like it's one of those things, right, that I think the internet has made everybody's brain sick, and like we all just refresh things constantly, and it's terrible, and we should all probably just get off social media, all that good stuff. I don't know. It's very hard to wean yourself off of doing it. And I don't know. They did add in some good news. They added a follow tab to Threads, so you don't have to have fucking algorithmically served things to you anymore. So I don't know if that changes your opinion, Bali, but I don't know.
I'll maybe set one up. I don't know.
Yeah, fine. We'll see. We're gonna have to figure out what we do with this goddamn podcast as well. Who knows? It's all a mess. But all I know is that I'm not calling it anything other than a tweet. That's what everyone's gonna call it. It's a tweet. Like,
I mean, what reassures me is the podcast kind of exists in multiple places.
Sure.
And
yeah,
we've got our Discord server, and like, so if one of these things were to ever shift, it feels like there's enough other things to help it shift onto the new platform, you would hope, or at least, I don't know. I feel a little bit reassured.
Yeah, we'll see. Anyway, it's the internet. Someone will invent something else. I don't know, maybe we'll get onto Blue Sky as well and see what's going on there. It's one of those weird things of like, oh no, I'm going to lose all my followers. But it's like, did any people really follow me really anymore? Because it's like built up from like other stuff and Pokemon, like, stuff from years.
It's all about engagement. It's not about followers necessarily.
Yeah. So We'll see. But hello, hi, we're here to talk about anything not social media. That's just video games on our video game consoles that we've been sitting there playing. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Before we get into all that stuff and what we're going to be talking about, I'd like to plug something. I was on the most recent episode of Infendo Radio, one of the longest running Nintendo podcasts. We had Justin back on the show back during Bally's paternity leave in last year, start of last year.
Yeah.
And yeah, I returned the favor and I guested on their show recently. So I'll leave a link to that in the show notes and on YouTube and everything. So you can go check that out. And yeah, it was a good, fun, short little show. And yeah, you can go listen to it and check them out and give them some love. So yeah, go over there. But Bally, what are we going to be talking about on here today's show?
For the first segment, we're going to talk about the games that we have been playing, one game in particular by the name of Pikmin 4. And then for the second segment, we're going to go into some emails and cover a couple of those.
Mm-hmm. So let's get straight into it. Obviously, we chatted a bit about the demo for Pikmin 4, which came out prior to the full release and was quite a bit in advance, actually. It was like 3 weeks or something before the full game came out, which is, it kind of like whet our appetites. And then I was like, oh man, I just really want to keep playing Pikmin 4 because the demo was so good. And that's what I proceeded to do. So I rolled credits on Pikmin 4 this morning. I finished it in about 18 hours with 100% of everything collected. However, that doesn't seem like it's the actual end. There is some more stuff after you roll credits and seems like it's worth doing. It's kind of a, talking on the Discord about it and saying it's kind of like a Mario 3D Land or 3D World situation where, you know, with 3D Land, reviewers weren't allowed to talk about after you do the eight worlds, it, you know, opens up another eight worlds and that's where the real game begins, basically. I don't think it's as significant as that, but it feels in that mold of Nintendo design where they're like, hey, have this experience and then here's more stuff for you, basically. I like that in some senses because it gives me more Pikmin to play. But it's one of those weird things where we often roll credits on things and we're like, it's always hard to go back to once you've rolled credits, you know? Mm-hmm. Like Zelda is a game that I'm struggling to get back to because I'm like, well, I did finish it, but I do want to go back and play some more stuff and make some weird contraptions. But Pikmin 4, it's a video game. Let's talk about it. Bally, how have you gotten on with Pikmin 4? I know you've been quite busy, so not got too deep, but...
Very busy. Turns out it's very tiring taking a baby on a plane for a long weekend and back again and then coming back to a new game in Pikmin 4 and being like, I just don't have the energy to play this game right now. So yeah, I'm only a few hours in. I'm in the second area and it felt really nice to just follow on from that demo. As we said, like we were both very positive on the demo and I'm really loving it so far. Like I'm getting much more used to Ochi, who is feeling a lot more like another crew member akin to Pikmin 3, but then he obviously has like a couple of extra abilities that are really nice too, and I'm sure he unlocks even more abilities when mm-hmm. you get even further in the game, but so far it's feeling really good, really fresh, and just learning ways of incorporating him into making everything more efficient. And then I've done like a couple of the, what do you call them, the Dandori?
Yeah, Dandori battles. So there's a kind of a couple of different versions of those. Have you done either version or both versions?
So
or?
One is like a versus yes. one, and then the other one is just like you versus the clock, right?
Yeah, it's an efficiency task thing, yeah. Which that's the one that I prefer personally.
Yeah, because it doesn't split the screen. Like, I was quite surprised it did that.
Yeah, and I really don't understand the whole splitting the screen situation. It's such a weird decision. Like, it's almost trying to emulate multiplayer, maybe because they built it for multiplayer, and you can do it from the menu, and maybe they were like, well, let's just put this in the main game, but because the infrastructure for multiplayer was set up already, they're like, well, let's just keep the split screen. It's a kind of bizarre decision because it limits your visibility in a game where I think that's kind of crucial to see like what is around the corner and what can you prioritize and trying to be efficient, right?
Yeah, exactly. And like I think what I really like about them is that they do teach you through showing you how to play the game more efficiently. So you can create shortcuts and break down this wall to get things that lead to that, but oh, you got to clear that route of enemies before you can just have your Pikmin deliver stuff along the route. And it's really good. I really enjoyed that stuff in Pikmin 3 especially, and there's a lot of the multiplayer with a friend in London, just both of us with like Wiimote nunchucks, just trying to get high scores on every single level it gave us and just trying to do that. And that was kind of like a cooperative time attack almost. It wasn't versus. I mean, you could do both, but we enjoyed the cooperative one the most. So this feels a bit... The time attack feels a bit like a single player version of that, which feels nice. And yeah, I think it's a bit jarring in the sense that like you have this really nice thematic overworld and then you're going underground and all of a sudden underground is like a toy box or something.
Sure,
like
yeah.
It feels a little bit shoehorned in that sense, but I still really like them. And I think it's just a nice way of mixing up the pace alongside like the caves. And it just feels like a really meaty game, and like that first area just feels so dense. And I thought, right, that area is dense but it's quite small, maybe the second area will be much larger, and it really isn't. If anything, it might even be even smaller and more dense, which mm-hmm. was interesting. So I'm in that second area, and thematically, like musically, it's beautiful. Like the second area is full of like spring blossom, and it's got like the Japanese like bamboo, almost like, you know, like the fences made of bamboo.
Yes.
So
you see
the bamboo when you're in like the dungeons in the like Sakura, the blossom area, which I just think is like a really nice thematic thing it's got going. And yeah, it's just a beautiful, stunning, relaxing, very enjoyable game so far for me.
Yeah, and I think maybe we touched on this when we talked about the demo, but this game feels quite different from Pikmin 3 in the sense that, and previous Pikmin games, in that there really is no time pressure. Like, you can spend as many days as you want in the overworld and doing all that sort of stuff, and the game's not going to punish you for it. It's not going to have a limit like the first game. It's not going to have a juice kind of barometer where you have to keep finding stuff to keep feeding yourself in order to stay alive.
Yeah.
You kind of have like a home hub base where all the characters that you find will populate there, and they'll give you quests and stuff that are kind of just like additive, because if you're doing 100%, which is kind of what this game encourages, you're going to just naturally do all that stuff anyway. But yeah, how do you feel about the lack of time pressure and that impacting kind of like the pace at which you play the game?
I think they did good things in Pikmin 3 to remove a lot of the time pressure, where there was an abundance of fruit that you then juiced to create more days. And I think by the end of the game, I was in like 12 days or something ridiculous of profit. So my point is, like, you would never actually run out of time, which leads you to the point, then why did they have time at all? And that's where I think it's important that games don't have two mechanics that juxtapose each other and break the theming. So like, what I mean by that is Pikmin thematically is about relaxing gardens and peaceful exploration, and adding a time pressure to that is a mechanic that goes massively against that. Now, add a time pressure mechanic to, say, Samus escaping some exploding planet, that thematically fits in. That's when like you're getting mechanics working together. But adding a time pressure, even if they are done by days, to Pikmin and making it kind of survival, it's like Nintendo want you to feel like this is, as much as this is a pretty relaxing world to explore, it's also a very dangerous world. And I don't actually think that's the case predominantly. And maybe you can talk about that in relation to like Pikmin 3 had these big gargantuan bosses that really were frightening and would eat 20 Pikmin at once sometimes, versus this game, which kind of leans away from bosses in the traditional style. So I don't know, it feels like Nintendo have said, we don't have this big scary bosses anymore, you can rewind time if you didn't like seeing your Pikmin get massacred. You can also, we've even taken all the time pressure off, and maybe they've realized actually Pikmin's at its best when it's slow, it's relaxed, and it's beautiful, and you take in the sights, the scenes, and hey, it will do the little bits of time pressure purely in the like Dandori versus levels, and so we'll give you a bit of that tension, but will take it away from the main overworld game. And I think it's a good balance so far.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think at the beginning of the game they were talking so much about Dandori, and I was like, well, you don't really need to do that anymore because there is no overarching pressure from a time perspective. But it's very much for those segments where you are specifically asked to do it. And I do like that it's kind of put into those because it feels like a good challenge. The only kind of not drawback to that is that otherwise you won't have been practicing for it necessarily, because the game talks about it a lot, but I wouldn't say that because there is a lack of time pressure doesn't necessarily make you do it. It's just like the end of a day, you might be, you know, close to messing or getting something. And
it's certainly like some of the efficiency mechanics, whether it's sending Archie somewhere or returning mm-hmm. him, and like that stuff initially is a little fiddly, and you do have to get your head around it. And you're right, the game doesn't say you need to learn to use Ochi in this way, otherwise you will fail at Dandori. It's like you just kind of work it out. I don't know. It's they could have, for a game that's so heavily tutorialized, it does kind of leave some of the more finicky mechanics up to you to work out.
Yeah, and there's a huge amount of commands you can give. Have you gone into the shortcut menu and scrolled down of like everything you can put on a D-pad? Because there's a lot of stuff. And thankfully, as we kind of mentioned from the demo, one of the most frustrating points there was just switching between Ochi and that one cave. You can just assign switch to a D-pad and it just instantly does it.
And it's very seamless. There's not even that. It doesn't feel like there's that delay like there was with the demo, which was weird. So
exactly. It's a lot easier and nicer. And there's an item that I got because there are some things actually I think early in the game that I was a bit like, oh, that's weird that this isn't in here, because this seems like a quality of life thing they would have put in here by now. But like getting the Pikmin to come back to you instead of running back to the base to get them, because they now have a not RPG system, but like you can level up your dog with stuff, you can also buy gear from the technician guy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you can buy is the idler's kind of like beacon, where wherever you are you can just, you know, use that. And I assigned that to Down on the D-pad, so I have access to it all the time, and that will just get Pikmin to go towards you. So it feels like once you have that, or once you have something that tells Pikmin go back to the home beacon, like that's where things become much more efficient. And you start to, there's an almost satisfaction of, you know, in a day you will start at a certain percentage and you'll end at a certain percentage, and there's a certain satisfaction to be like, I started the day on 47%, I ended the day on 85%. That was a good day. I got a lot achieved day. And I think like there's no reward for it. There's no like, hey, you did it everything in under this number of days, so you're rewarded for it. It just kind of feels good. And it's like, it almost is that Stardew Valley kind of do the thing the next day because you saw something over there right as the day was ending and you want to go back and do it. And so it leads to this loop of, the game is quite hard to put down, I found, because mm-hmm. I wanted to just get everything and I knew where things were, and I'm like, right, tomorrow I'm going to be able to go and do that. So it segments it nicely, and it stops you from kind of getting bogged down, I think, by having some of that stuff. So yeah, I think it's pretty cool. The caves are definitely, it feels like, the core part of this game, where everything is, because I did tend to find that in the overworld I could spend an entire day where I was just in the overworld and I'd get a bunch of stuff, and at the end of the day it would be like, you got 5% more. I'm like, I'm feeling that, okay. Because really, like, all the treasures and all the stuff are hidden in these caves, and they start out quite small, you know, only a couple of floors or whatever. By the end of the game, I think the most I had was 6 floors, maybe, was the longest one. But, you know, they start to get 4, 5, 6 floors by the end of the game. And some of these can take, like, an hour, right? Like, they take a long time, because if you want to clean everything up, if you want to get everything, then it's very much a, you know, you want to be as efficient as possible doing that stuff.
God, they're satisfying to do, though. Like,
it's so satisfying. Out,
like, none of the puzzles so far, and I'm interested now that you've kind of seen credits,
mm-hmm.
are any of the puzzles that tricky, or is everything like, oh yeah, okay, you just put that to here and you freeze that, they walk over it, or, you know, is everything,
it generally stays like an even keel. It's never too challenging, but there are moments of like, oh, I'm not quite sure what to do here, I do have to think a bit to figure out how do I get over there. And some of it is like, well, there's a fan here and there's another fan there. If I step on this switch, that turns on one, okay, but it turns the other off. So I have to keep my character over here and send Ochi over with all the Pikmin, and then switch back to my character to switch the switch to then jump with Ochi so that he can get... Like, there was one section in the fourth area today where I did have to think quite a bit in order to get around it. And that goes for enemies as well, where those crabs are motherfuckers. I don't know if you've come across the crabs yet, but... the crabs, when I first came across them, I was like, these pieces of shit. Because one of my favorite things to do is just get the army of Pikmin and press the, I think it's X, and they will just charge at things, and that's how you, like, early game anyway, you just destroy everything by doing that, because they just, like, it's like a swarm of locusts just, like, devouring something, and it feels so satisfying to do. But the crabs are these motherfuckers, because the first time I did that to them, he basically, like, lifts his legs and then slams down underneath, and I'm like, fuck, like, I sent all of them, and then he just fucking sits on them, and yeah, that's not great. And they were tricky as well, because you need, like, rock Pikmin in order to kind of break their shell so that their big claw goes away, because their claw goes in a wide arc, scoops up Pikmin and eats them up. So he was a bit of a son of a bitch, and I actually ended up using some items to fight him a couple of times, because I was I'm just going to throw a bomb, and the bomb does a great job of, like, dealing a bunch of damage. And I didn't go too much into the items, and I tend to not in these games, you know, like, there were a few times where Ochi's health was low, and so I got out one of the bones to heal him, but yeah, at least, like, there were some challenges later in the game where I'm like, yeah, maybe I will use items here to help things out and kind of smooth it.
Did you predominantly buff Ochi as a, like, attacking tank, or just like a lorry?
Yeah, I definitely upgraded his rush ability, because I found that quite useful. It's really good in the walls, that where you're kind of digging away at those walls. Definitely very helpful there.
Just charging into the walls as fast, you mean?
No, it does more damage basically with his charge. So if you upgrade his rush ability, he does more impact damage. And so you can, there are some times where there's a bunch of small enemies in a row, and I just charged up Ochi, and just, he just basically did a line all the way through them and just takes them all out in one, which is very satisfying also. I think the nicest thing about Ochi for me is, in previous Pikmin games, right, you could get caught up where you're running, but there's always a trail behind you, right? And so Pikmin are, like, following you, but there's, like, you almost have, like, your shadow behind you, right? There's a ghost image, but it's Pikmin who are trailing your exact movement.
You need them as flowers, Pikmin, because then they'll keep up with you better.
I'm sure, games, yes. I mean, yeah. Yeah, totally. But obviously, you know, Pikmin will get hit all the time, and they'll take a bit of damage, they'll go back to leafs and all that sort of stuff. And so in previous games, you would run around sometimes, and be like, just get over here just in time, and you have to almost preempt what enemy moves were going to be so that you couldn't accidentally get them caught in the crossfire because of the delay between you running past and an enemy attack happening.
I mean, you still get that in this game on foot.
You do, but if you have Ochi, then they all just jump together onto you, and it really minimizes Pikmin death, in the sense that because no one's straggling behind, they're all on this one ball together, you can approach big enemies and bosses in a much safer way, which I guess to some degree makes the game a lot easier, not having that risk associated.
It's like defensive mode, because if you say fighting a big enemy, I agree with your tactic defensively. But then when you want to attack, you can only do the rush mode, right?
That's true, your
character is off Ochi. So it's like the game's encouraging you, right?
Well, not quite, actually. Not quite, because if you rush with Ochi, as soon as he hits something, all the Pikmin on top will jump on as well.
But that means you get you can't do it with one specific type.
That's true. Yes, yeah, that's true. You can't just do one at once. Yeah. So yeah, there is a slight drawback. I don't think it's a big enough drawback to make it worse.
It just depends on the enemy, but yeah.
Yeah, I tended to find that when I was fighting bosses or whatever, I would be on Ochi because I could select which Pikmin specifically I wanted to throw, and then I just jam the A button, and usually you kind of get what you need out of that anyway, right? Especially when you're freezing enemies. Like, holy shit, ice Pikmin are overpowered as hell. Yes, they are so good, because if you get them attached to anybody, like, as soon as they fill up that circle, then you have way more time to just deal out damage. So, like, they are a priority, and I had ice Pikmin for a lot of the game with me because they were just so useful in so many situations, and yeah, just that the idea of freezing enemies was crucial in order to, you know, basically kill enemies faster than you may have done otherwise. And it made, like, bosses tended to be, like, when you got down into the bottom of caves, it would be enemies who are, like, kind of a little bit different, slightly larger variants. Like, there were a few large ones and ones that were maybe a bit more comparative to previous Pikmin, but I do think that's a slight disappointment with this game.
A real highlight of Pikmin 3 was some of those bosses. Like, they were scary and ugly, and had, like, one of them had, like, a big tongue that it would just, like, swoop up 40 Pikmin at once and swallow, and you'd be like, oh, holy shit, like, I've messed this up.
Yeah,
like,
there was the giant kind of long-legged one. There was the kind of the first one, the crystal guy with the shell underground.
Right, the crystal was great. Great showcase of Rock Pikmin. Yeah.
Exactly. So, like, and they had really interesting mechanics tied to them. And, like, there's a little bit of that here, but I think because the caves are such a crux of this game, the game isn't built to... Every area is kind of an open world space, right? And I think in previous Pikmin games, you started at one area and you kind of needed the abilities to kind of get to the next areas. And it was less open. It was a little more linear in that sense. Like, you could, once you broke through a barrier, then you could get to a more open space. But it always was funneling you towards a space where a boss would end up being. And because this entire world is just completely go wherever you want to begin with, it there's less like... gating for here's a section where you would go through and fight a boss. And I think one of the things that is a little bit of a shame is, especially the earlier caves, and this doesn't change until later, they all kind of look similar when you go underground. And so it's like, I'm in a kind of a dark hole, and there's nothing like exciting visually about the space that you're fighting in.
Bamboo in the second area, I like that a lot.
Yeah, there's nice. Like background stuff though, right? And yeah. Like it's generally taking the aesthetics of the area you're in, but there's no unique boss areas. Like I think about in Pikmin 3, the giant sand mound, right? Like that is really...
And they're in the overworld in Pikmin 3, they're not underground or anything, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it feels like a bit more of a sense of place there. And, you know, I think, like, it's maybe a minor complaint, but it is something that I missed from this game, and I think that it would be nice to bring that stuff back, because I never felt...
What do you think the logic was? Were they too difficult or scary, and they want this to be easier in a wider audience or something?
Maybe, yeah, that could be the case. I don't know. Like, there is an enemy at some point in the game that is terrifying and is, like, the opposite of every part of the game. It was one of my least favorite sections of the game, but it's basically a thing that chases you that you can't kill, and it lasts for a long time. It lasts for, like, the entire cave sequence, and I was like, man, because what I did was I just tried to collect everything one time through. I didn't want to go back into caves to go and collect everything, so I was like,
right.
I'm just going to do this, but, like, every time it would, like, come around a corner, I'd be like, I need to get up, save my Pikmin, because they're going to just die instantly to this thing. And so that
and
entire
you can't
sequence...
defeat it.
There's a thing that you have to do, but like you'll see when you get there.
Okay.
It's like a big pressure that the rest of the game doesn't feel like it has in that one area.
Yeah.
And it felt wrong because the rest of the game was so relaxed, right? In that way, and the game underground gives you infinite time, because when you come back up to the surface, like, some time will have passed, but it will never go past the 10-second timer. Like, the worst you can do is you can pop out and it'll be like, right, 10 seconds to go. So you can spend as long as you want down there. I think this kind of dragged against that, because it was like providing a pressure that wasn't what the rest of the game had set up. But, you know, it felt good to finally, you know, get out of that place and you know, spend more time in the overworld and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I can't remember what our original point. I guess we're kind of just talking about
just
bosses,
the lack of bosses
and,
is a little bit of a shame. But,
yeah, it's a bit of a shame. It's not great. But how do you feel about stuff like these kind of NPCs that you're rescuing and that sort of stuff? It seems like you haven't got to the night stuff yet.
No, I haven't. And like the number of like crew mates does seem a little bit overwhelming, and it seems like there's an awful lot of dialogue and things to do between days, and that's fine. Like, I think that adding the mechanics of upgrading Ochi is cool, so I guess it's just, is that the best way of implementing all these mechanics? Probably, I guess, but like it can make the time between days drag a little bit, but at the same time I don't know how else they could have done that if they wanted to implement all these other mechanics. And like I said when we talked about the demo, like, I do really miss the overworld map at the end of the day showing you how your Pikmin moved around. And also I still miss like the juicing of that juice, the fruit. It was, I wanted this game to have, there's almost like this magical like way, it's done with like the lighting, and it's night and the music. There's something about the end of day feeling of Pikmin, like, whoa, this is kind of, it's like the space age magical music kind of thing at the same time. It's I don't know how to describe it perfectly, but it's a really lovely feeling that I feel like I got a little more from Pikmin 3 than I do from this game. And I think they just didn't quite transfer that magic in the same way with that end of day satisfying feeling of like just that night music or whatever you call it. Like, I don't know. I just, there's little things around the edges where I'm like, oh, that could have been better. But I still think the overall experience is stronger, probably.
Yeah, like I think there's a satisfaction of here's all the stuff you collected today type of thing instead. Like it basically gives you a breakdown of here are the people you rescued, here are all the treasures that you collected, and here is your percentage, what it was before, now it's at this. So it's kind of a different kind of approach, and I still liked it because I liked... Also, it's really nice that when you get all the treasures in a collection, it gives you additional points for that. And so, I mean, my Sparklium was like, by the time I was halfway through the second area, I could already do the fourth area of the game because I had 100%ed everything. And so I had so much Sparklium that I was like well over the line of what I needed. But you get additional Sparklium for completing an entire set of treasures. And it is, I did spend a bit of time today after I finished the game looking at a few of them and reading some of the descriptions. Like, it's just really funny stuff like the Game Boy SP, right? Like, you can go into the viewer and you can press the button for it to like close and open and stuff like that. There's some really nice touches, and some of the games that you pick up that are represented in here are like really deep cuts that I'm like, what are you doing, Nintendo? Like, are you trying to bait people here of like trying to say something's going to happen with these franchises potentially? There is one game in particular that is in this one of the treasures you can find that is one of your favorite games, Bally. So I'm very excited for you find that and pick it up, and maybe that will give you some false hope about what Nintendo will do. But I'm like, what? Okay, they never talk about this, but you know, they're throwing it in here, which I think is kind of fun. I really like that they have, obviously people talk about Switch being underpowered and all that sort of stuff, and like, holy shit, this game looks good.
It
looks so nice in that model viewer in particular, when you zoom in on something and it's like in Astro's Playroom, right? Like, one of the best parts of that game is going to that showroom and just looking at PlayStations in detail in HD, and Nintendo pull off the same thing on Switch with these older kind of pieces of hardware and cartridges and all that sort of stuff. It's really, really nice, and just has a great kind of sheen to it in a way that you look at it and you're like, wow, they're still pulling off some really cool stuff on Switch at this point.
I think overall, like, I'm obviously very early and you've beaten the game, but like, I'm very impressed. I really hope that this is, you know, the Fire Emblem Awakening of Pikmin.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
And what I mean is that that's Pikmin, mechanically Pikmin has the chops to be a Zelda or a Mario, or, you know, like, what I mean by that is games like Fire Emblem, Xenoblade, they're longer, they're more detailed, they're arguably aimed at a slightly more hardcore audience, you know, there's a lot more mechanics. Pikmin is mechanically far more simple and not easy necessarily.
Approachable,
but like,
I guess.
More approachable, more maybe family orientated. I'm not saying Fire Emblem and Xenoblade aren't necessarily, but it's a slightly different demographic. And I think the Pikmin also just mechanically isn't that far away from games like Mario and Zelda, to be honest. Like, there's loads of things it has in common, and but at the same time, it doesn't sell anywhere near like what those games are. And we mentioned this off mic, but like, obviously with the other games coming out on Wii U and GameCube, it's kind of a rough ride when those consoles don't sell particularly well. So obviously this will become, and I think it already is, the best-selling Pikmin.
Yeah, I think in Japan its sales are like four times the previous games.
Totally, but
so
I'm hoping this can be, you know, like, it should be in the discussion around games like Luigi's Mansion 3. It should be selling 8-9 million potentially.
Right.
And I think that would be an amazing result for the Pikmin franchise, and it could hopefully get another game on the next Nintendo hardware. Like, that would be my hope, because I think a game like Luigi's Mansion 3, we were really pleasantly surprised by the amount of like Nintendo energy and mechanics in that game. And I'm not, maybe what I've seen so far in Pikmin isn't surprising me as much as Luigi's Mansion 3, but that's probably because Pikmin 3 was incredibly good and very surprising. But it's still so nice to have such a beautiful looking new Pikmin game on Switch that it just is gorgeous.
How would you rank the water in this game comparative to water in other games?
Water.
It's pretty good.
It looks pretty damn good. It does look very good.
Yeah. It's very hard to compete with like more modern AAA stuff these days, but like, I think for what they're doing,
Horizon Forbidden West has kind of blown the competition out of the water.
But for what they're doing, like, I think that there's some really impressive stuff here. And, you know, I really like that Ochi, obviously, he grows up eventually and is like, now I can swim. He can't to begin with. It's like, there, now I can.
He can just
take
stick
all the
Pikmin on his back and swim across spaces. Like, there's just mechanically, Ochi is such a great addition because he adds all these mechanics, but he's also just really well animated and very cute. And everyone, there's all this chat about cats, and I can't take any more of it. Like, it's cats in games, who cares? I don't care. I'm a dog person, and Ochi is representing dogs. So that's going to win game of the year. Simple as that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's very simple. You can't pet Ochi, though, so points all taken away for that. So what are you going to do? It's a shame. But yeah, I think like... Generally, the game feels, I think, less complex than Pikmin 3, and I think that's just necessity from the control standpoint and the kind of less micromanaging nature of it. And I think that means it will appeal to a wider audience. I think more people will jump in because it has more approachable kind of nature to it.
Do you ever get to that point? So Pikmin 3, like, those last few areas in Pikmin 3 are like your three different...
You
pilots,
are a commander, right? Really?
Like you're directing three different people with three groups of Pikmin doing three different things, and then they link.
Yes.
At the moment, it's just me and Ochi. Like, does it ever go to a third branch, or do you maybe not want to spoil that if it does? Or
I don't know. I haven't fully finished the game because there's more stuff to come. So maybe there will be. At this point, no. Maybe this segues a little bit into the nighttime segments because there's a little bit more of that there. So. I don't know how much you know about these, Bally, but they kind of talked about them in the Nintendo Direct or whenever they kind
of believe
in
the, I believe there's like night Pikmin or like dark Pikmin or
they're
something.
They're glow Pikmin is what they're called.
Which
so.
Is just a massive copy of that game, which was already copying Pikmin. What was that game we played?
The Wild at Heart, that's the one,
And I thought a unique thing about The Wild at Heart, as much as it was copying Pikmin, was that they introduced like moon... what are they called in that game?
Fake Pikmin, yeah.
They basically have moon Pikmin in that game, The Wild at Heart. And the advantage of moon Pikmin is that you can use them at night and they can like fight some of the really horrendous bad...
Oh, God,
big bads in that game at night. And they have like this moon power, but then they're a bit hopeless during the day. And I was like, wow, that's a really clever twist on Pikmin, like doing stuff at night. And then to see it revealed in the Nintendo Direct that like... there's nighttime stuff in this game. I'm like, interesting. Like,
yeah,
I don't think they took one from the other in terms of development cycles, but I still think that's fascinating they went for that.
It's very interesting. And I think like it didn't work the way I expected it to in the game. So my expectation was, oh, you can be out at night. So I thought like, oh, you can opt to, instead of ending the day after, you know, however long.
Right. That's what happens in The Wild at Heart.
Yeah, exactly. I thought, like, they're just going to let you stay outside at night and continue, and it just is more dangerous. There's more dangerous enemies around and all that sort of stuff. That's not how it works. So basically, you'll get a new NPC in your hub who will be like, let's go on night expeditions. And night expeditions are essentially tower defense segments. So the way that it works is that you have this big hive, this kind of glowing mound in the ground, and that's where the glow Pikmin come from. That's where they live. And Nintendo, for some reason, you know, Skyward Sword, Mario Galaxy, they keep returning to the same object again and again. Star bits are back, Bally. You are collecting what are basically star bits, like in little pools. So basically the entire map is at night, but you don't really have access to things that you would during the day, like the caves or whatever. Your entire objective is here's a timer, and enemies are going to come towards your luminoles, I think they're called, Knoll, K-N-O-L-L, which is fun because luminol is also the name of a substance that is used in court cases and stuff like that to like find fingerprints. The reason I know that is because Phoenix Wright, one of the cases, you have to spray luminol on a bunch of stuff in order to find fingerprints. So that's fun that they have a little bit of a pun name there. But you basically... what sometimes happens with these is sometimes you'll have two of those. And so to come back to your question about splitting stuff, you can command Ochi to guard one of those. So you can say, Ochi, guard this. I will go off and, you know, take on the other one, and I'll go and find star bits in the environment. It's really different, though, because when you throw glow Pikmin or you tell them to do a job, They will take the Starbits back to base, and then they will evaporate and appear right back next to you. So you have no micromanaging in terms of calling them to you. They just come towards you exactly from where they were, and this means that what you can do is you can go off with your character, take a bunch of glow Pikmin with you, collect a bunch of stuff. There's also like mini hubs where you can find a mini one which will act as a node, so that if you're really far away from the main base, you can have the glow Pikmin go to that one because it's a bit closer by, and they'll take less time to come back to you. So you can activate those. Those have less health and they'll die quicker to enemies. But eventually enemies start coming towards you and they'll have like red eyes and everything, and you have to basically just tower defense it. So there will be music.
Why do they have red eyes?
Because they go crazy at night. I don't know. It's one of those things. This is not explained. There'll be music cues of like, oh, Ochi is being attacked at the other base, so you can then switch over to Ochi. And the nice thing is, as soon as you switch over to him, all the glow Pikmin that were with your character will just evaporate and appear with Ochi. So there's a real kind of like seamlessness to it. In some senses, it just makes it a little too easy because there's really no micromanaging going on. You are basically just like going out collecting things to build up your armies. And what happens is the star bits you get will give you more glow Pikmin to work with. So you collect a bunch of them, then you can use them to attack enemies. And they also have a really overpowered ability where when you usually charge things up, right, Pikmin will just swarm the enemy instantly. This, for glow Pikmin, you charge them up and they all go into this big globular ball, and this ball kind of hovers in the air and it will home in on either a bunch of enemies or one big enemy, and they will just like attach to it and just kind of eat away at it very quickly. So it is a version of the charge, but it feels like even more effective in a sense because it's this kind of giant floating ball that will home in on targets, and is very good. And the reason you go out at night is because the Luminols produce this substance that basically heals the leaf characters who come back. So all right. The people with leaves on their face, the way that you get them back to be normal, course, NPCs, yeah, is you collect this substance. So that's the reason that you're doing this kind of expedition. And each one has a difficulty level, like the Dandori, where it's like 1 to 5, like fire level essentially, of how difficult they are. And by the end of the game, I didn't do any in the fourth area. I'd done the first, second, and third area ones, and I it only got up to 3 difficulty, and I've only done 2 so far. So I haven't seen how hard it gets on 3 or 4 or 5. My expectation actually is like, now that I finish the main game and I go back to the other stuff that I have to do, it's gonna just step up in difficulty.
Right. And is it part of the percentage?
What do you mean?
Like the completion
overall
percentage. Of...
So the way the completion percentage works is at the end of the game, it will just show you each area. And you can see this like whenever you go to areas, it'll just say per area how much percent you have. I don't know what counts towards like 100. But basically all I want to do is just 100% each area, essentially.
That's what I want to do as well, yeah. So I'm just working out if I have to do all the nighttime challenges.
No, you don't have to do that. Oh, if you... Okay. I guess not, no, because 100%ing an area just means collecting everything within it. So it doesn't require you to heal the leaflings. Like, that's just a thing you can do at base. If you want to do all the side quests, you probably would have to do all the nighttime missions, okay, because all the side quests tie to everything else in the game, so you get extra material to spend on upgrades and items or whatever by doing those side quests. So, you know, there's a guy who gives you a bunch of materials every time you 100% an area. There's someone who gives you, every time you get 300 Pikmin fully bloomed with like flowers in their head, then you get stuff from them. Like, every single thing you could think of, the game is basically rewarding you for. So every single character in the hub area will have some side quest tied to them that will tie into essentially doing everything in the game at some point. So no, you don't, if you want to just get 100% on all the areas, you don't have to do the night missions. I probably won't do them all, if I'm honest. And I think they're cool and they're a nice little thing to kind of break the pace. So if you've done like a really long day and you spent like 2 caves or whatever, it's nice to come back and just do a night mission because they're quite short and they're easy. And they just feel very frictionless at the moment because I'm just able to like go off on my own, take these glow Pikmin, and then quickly switch to Ochi if I need to, and, you know, repeat the process. And okay, usually I've been finishing them early, so either the timer runs out so you survive, or you kill all the enemies in the area. And often I've just been killing all the enemies before the timer even has time to run out. So right. So yeah, I imagine they will get harder, but yeah,
doesn't feel a bit dry because you've only got one type of Pikmin.
Yeah, a little bit. Like, it's a different approach because it's more tower defense-y. It's much more about managing, like, should I be... Basically, it's a risk-reward of, like, should I go further away, but then I'm going to have to run all the way back to my knoll to protect it, essentially. So okay. There's a balance there of what you want to do and whether it's worth it. But yeah, Nintendo Life put a video up that was like, Nintendo hid the real challenge in Pikmin 4, and my guess is that, like, the post-game stuff is going to have much more challenging stuff because... you know, I definitely think the end of the game gets a bit more difficult, but it has overall been a pretty easy breezy experience. Like, I don't think Pikmin's like an overly challenging series generally, but like, no. Pikmin 3 had some tricky bosses, like you said, right?
There were some tricky parts, yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it's I think it's a tremendous game in a lot of different ways, and I think it streamlines, and in some senses it just loses a little bit of the complexity by doing that, but I think it kind of is worth it to kind of get more people into the series because stuff like just having the aiming be automatic and like just the seamlessness of the camera actually makes a big difference as well. Like I feel much more like a small character in a big world with that camera change. And, you know, some of the areas you get to later, it's like, oh, this is really cool. Just seeing all this stuff as a tiny character walking around. And I like that a lot, but I also like that they give you the option with the analog stick to kind of give you almost a zoomed out view. If you pull back on the stick, it will give you an almost Pikmin 3 perspective, which is nice. So they kind of provide it in every way, and they have ways of just giving you the experience that you want out of the game. So yeah, I've really enjoyed it, and I definitely want to continue and finish all the stuff and do it all, because yeah, I'm not satisfied yet. I don't have my fill, and I think that's the good thing about this, is it gives you a lot of opportunities. And this, I think there's something else as well that I haven't I've seen people talking about that I haven't got to yet. So feels like finishing Pikmin 4 is only kind of half the story, and there's a lot more to do. So excited to dig into more of that. And yeah, I think that will probably do us. Any final thoughts, Bally?
I'm also very keen to just play more. I'd like to 100% this game as well, even though I am lagging behind on a few games. I still just feel like this feels like my jam, and I'm really loving it, so I'd like to get to it. I think it's like 33 hours to 100%, although it sounds like you'll get there much sooner than that. So
I think I probably will. I'll probably spend another 7-8 hours with it, I imagine.
So I'll probably be about 33 on the dot, but yeah, and I'm probably only like 3-4 hours in now, so I've got a long way to go, but it's really good so far. It's cool. I'm looking forward to it.
And I think, yeah, this game really does encourage you to 100% it. It feels like, because there's no time pressure, like, that's the purpose. It's like, hang out in this world and just pick everything up, right? Like, there are so many little...
game. It's very chill.
Yes, it is. Like, there's so many little touches. Like, I love how the rumble, every time your Pikmin, like, jump on Ochi, they're like, da-da-da-da-da-da, and you feel it in the controller. Like, I love the little stuff like that that's very satisfying. Sound design has always been great in Pikmin, but just, like, the satisfaction of, like, cracking through something or picking up objects or the little sounds that they make.
Or Pikmin's body just squelching underneath an
enemy. Oh, God, the worst sound, the worst sound.
Ghosts sound like...
yeah, like, oh, God, that's terrible, heart-wrenching sounds. But I feel like I was on a big body of water, and I was floating around with my Pikmin, and they started singing, and I was like, are they doing a sea shanty? Because I'm like going around on the water. I was like, okay, that's really
they
neat.
May sing sometimes when they're on Ochi's back. It's just like, we're going from A to B, and we're kind of like on a school bus that sing a song kind of vibe.
It's like, it's hi-ho, really hi-ho, it's off to work we go, the seven dwarves, the 100 Pikmin. It's cool. And on streamlining again, the notion that you can click an auto option and it will give you the three most efficient types for that area, like, it's such a cool feature, because it's like, I click that, I see, okay, this is what they recommend for this area, I'm gonna shuffle it around to give myself the ones that I want, or the numbers that I want for each of those. But same with the dungeons, where it's like, you go down into this dungeon and it's like, these are the ones you're going to use. I thought you could actually choose. You can't choose when it comes to the dungeons. They will say you have to use these types. And I found this out because I went down into one dungeon where it was like, you can only have water Pikmin. And I went down there and there were like tons of fire enemies. And I'm like, surely I can't do this. But the game forces you to do that because you're like in a tough position with just water Pikmin, and there's fire enemies, right, and there's other ways of killing them basically and getting around it, which is really neat. So the game does have interesting challenges when it comes to some of the later caves, and I think that's really good. So just the whole notion of just preparing you for what Pikmin you're going to need and then telling you which ones you have to use in the caves is great.
It also streamlines things where, like Pikmin 3, you can just like point to spots on map, and your character will run there, or you can tell Ochi to go there, or maybe less. It's harder with Ochi, but anyway. And it's fun because when you are commanding Ochi and you go to your menu, you then have the option of sending your main character back to the base or like back to another point. It's stuff like that. It's all very... everything feels like it's just like two button presses away or something. Like it's pretty streamlined. It's very, very cleverly done.
Yeah, I think the map just really helps with that, and you can set the map to either follow exactly behind where you are, your direction, or you can set it to kind of be like a north, south, east, west situation. Right. And I think it's very smooth to do that. But the map is very good at indicating what you have on. You know, it's left to collect. I love that it's like you can walk up to a cave and, you know, pop its hood, but you don't have to enter it. And then on the map, it will have the little arrow icon to say you haven't done this one yet. Yeah. Versus the little flag that says
they want
I have
you to 100%
this
game. They're like exactly. crying out
yeah.
for it.
Yeah, the map is like built for you to be like, hey, by the way, here is a treasure. It's a big star on the map. Remember, this is here. Here's where the onion is. Like, as soon as you found something and you maybe don't have the stuff to get it, I love that it just puts it on the map to remind you so that next time when you have the right Pikmin set up or you know, you're in the right frame of mind or you have enough time to do it, you can just go out on a mission and be like, okay, I'm going to do the left-hand side of this map today because I have all these things that I can now collect and get. And like even with the bridges as well, the bridges will show that they're fully done. And yeah, like it's really built for 100%ing. And I think it's a different approach for a Pikmin game, but I think it really works. And, you know, there's a sense that it's almost like a 3D collectathon platformer, right? There's a weird kind of feeling that's similar to that, which I think is quite nice. And it's a good compromise.
You can now jump with Ochi. You can't jump in any other Pikmin game. So there's a tiny bit of platforming in there.
Exactly, yeah. So you do have to manage that. And there's certainly places where it's like, well, I can't get up here without him, so I'm going to have to bring him back and then hop over. And yeah, some neat puzzles that kind of build around that idea. But overall, I think there's just like a real satisfying brain gooiness to Pikmin, you know, where you're just like, I'm going to throw these guys at a thing. They're going to walk with it. And then you see the long line of them like building a bridge and they pop it down and just, again, the sound design, just the colors. Oh,
I'm here to, I'm just here to hear some really nice sound design and see some very satisfying things and just fill gauges, tick boxes.
Uh-huh.
It just feels, it all comes together really nicely.
It's a tick box video game, and it's one of the best ones out there for that. Like, it really is. So if you have not played Pikmin and somehow have listened to an hour of us talking about it so far, I strongly encourage people to pick this up. As you said, like, it's not a series that gets a lot of attention or as much as it deserves.
I have been so disappointed in my podcast circles how little it's been covered. It really speaks to, like, you know, if it's not Mario or Zelda or someone has a particular passion, so many games get like left out, and Pikmin just feels like a real strong candidate for this kind of game that often gets left out of the discussion.
So do go play Pikmin if you have not, you can play them all on Switch now, which is awesome. Like,
it's really cool,
every single really game cool. in the series, and you can go through from the very beginning, which I would like to go back to 1 and 2. I am a bit scared about it.
I'm very keen to go to 1 and 2.
Because I think like the thing that 3 and 4 have done is like they're such modern ass games. Like, there's so many conveniences and nice things, and you know, I don't know. I'm a little worried about going back to those originals, but I would like to at some point just to kind of fill out the catalog.
They're much shorter games. So even if you get a horrendous like game over and you run out of days or however it works, I don't know. It's not that bad.
I think the first one's like 5 hours. I've heard Pikmin 2 is much longer than that, but first one you can knock out quite easily. So. Anyway, that is going to do us for the first segment of the show. We'll be back after the break with some of your emails. Don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the second part of today's show. It is time again for emails. If you would like to send an email into the show, please email thisnintendolife@gmail.com. That is thisnintendolife@gmail.com. You can also post a comment, a question on our Discord server. We have a channel dedicated to emails just to ask your questions, make a comment. Link to our Discord server in the notes. So, yeah, check that out. It's a nice little community we've got building over there. It's a good time. It's if Twitter suddenly crashes tomorrow, which seems likely, jump into the Discord server. We'll hang out.
Get on it.
We'll survive. We've got a couple of Discord questions this time, actually. The first one is from Noah on Discord. Says, good day, gents. Following the success of the Nintendo Switch and the Steam Deck, do you foresee Sony re-entering the portable gaming market with another system like the PSP or PS Vita? Why or why not? Best wishes, Noah.
The eternal question. Do Sony want to get defeated by Nintendo yet again for the third time on the trot? It's such an interesting thing where, like, seemingly handheld gaming was dead because of, you know, the Vita not doing very well, and 3DS had a really rocky start for a while, and mobile gaming was becoming such a resurgence, and everyone was like, well, we're not going to have any handheld games because everyone's just going to play on their phones. And I was like, this sounds like the worst future possible. Please never let this happen.
Nintendo saved us.
Nintendo did save us. They came in and they're like, hey, but what about if you could also put it on your television? So I think that's the thing, right? As soon as the Switch became a success, Valve looked at it and they were like, yeah, how about this handheld PC thing? That's probably a good idea. We're now in a place where I think handhelds are kind of hotter than ever, right? And part of this is the kind of resurgence or the kind of interest in retro handhelds and emulation that has just boomed in the last few years, essentially. Lots of people just buying these small handheld devices. There's a whole like subculture and market around it. There's like 500 of these different devices you can buy. You now have stuff like the Asus ROG Ally coming in at the higher end of that stuff, also trying to do a Steam Deck but on a Windows machine. Like, because of the success of Switch and then subsequently Steam Deck also doing really well, I think a lot of people are looking at it and thinking, hey, like, this is still a viable market, a place where people are wanting things, and people are wanting a variety of experiences. They're wanting console focused stuff, they're wanting stuff that is better on a handheld device, like smaller games. You know, I've been chipping away at Rogue Legacy 2 for like the last 3-4 months, and it's because it's on Steam Deck, and I don't think I would have done that had Steam Deck not existed, because it's right next to my bed, and as soon as I go to sleep, I'm like, I can do a few runs of Rogue Legacy 2, and it's great, and it's beautiful. But also, I played a Plague Tale Innocence all the way on Steam Deck, and that was also a nice, like, it's kind of a little bit scary because there's like darkness and rats and stuff, and I'm like, I prefer this on a handheld, so I also played that in bed. So there's like a good flexibility to these devices, and I think Sony were always in that arena, right? Like the Vita and the PSP, I remember when we were younger, we looked at them, we were like, wow, the graphics are so much better on like the PSP, right? And like somewhat jealously, I think, as DS boys, but in some senses it was like, but there's not that much on there, right? Like, it's like, okay, there's... I remember looking at Ali T's PSP, and there was a Star Wars game he had on there, and I was like, whoa, like, the graphics on this are insane. Right. But, like, aside from... Like, there were Sony franchises like Patapon and Loco Roco, but, like, there wasn't any big stuff that I was that interested in.
Our tastes at the time. Like, I do think our tastes have changed. Our tastes are far wider now, so, like, we're much more into a lot of Sony franchises now than we used to be. Mm-hmm. And yet, like, the circle pads were completely flat on the original.
There was
PSP.
Only one on the PSP as well. One?
It felt weird. I remember playing, like, a bit of GTA on someone's PSP. I was like, I guess this looks impressive, but God, it feels like ass. Like, it just feels so bad.
Totally. So, yeah, they were always going in the kind of console direction. With their handhelds.
Yeah, I mean... So what's your verdict? Is it coming?
Well, I mean, we can maybe talk about something that Sony is releasing. It's a little thing called Project
Q. A Wii U gamepad.
Which, yeah, remember the GameCube keyboard controller? How they just had the handles on the side of a giant keyboard? It really reminds me of that. They just basically, someone just took a lightsaber to a PS5 controller and then were like, okay, let's just stick an iPad in the middle of this. Hey, presto, this is the device we're going to sell. Like, I think it does look incredibly dumb. Like, it is one of the least ergonomic things I think I've ever seen. And it, honestly, it looks like... like, you see all the time, like, fan creations of, like, here's what a Sony handheld would look like. It honestly, like, if this hadn't come from an official PlayStation channel and I'd seen that on the internet, I would have just been like, oh yeah, that's like a dumb Photoshop. Yeah. And it's not. It's a real product that they're going to sell. And it's just, it's a really weird approach because it is, it's a handheld that you can only use on internet connections, like, locally for your home, for your PS5. So you already have to own a PlayStation 5, and then you also have to own this thing that doesn't have any storage. It just streams it directly to it. Like, it's such a narrow use case, especially when you think about how streaming works with other devices and, like, with PCs and all that sort of stuff. Like, the Xbox's flexibility with xCloud, all that sort of stuff, it just feels very narrow and, like, for the most hardcore PlayStation people, and really no one outside of that market. I don't know, what's your take on this weird thing?
It's interesting, but I think it shows the direction that the kind of handheld market is going from the perspective of a company like Sony. And what I mean by that is that in an ideal world, Sony want all their development studios to be working on video games that are coming out on one platform. Mm-hmm. Or like you develop one game, but it can run on multiple platforms easily. Like, it's not an issue of, like, oh, we got to do a version for the PC and a version right. for the PS5. And we've seen how difficult they've been having it, trying to get the PC versions to run smoothly on launch. They don't want that problem again for, like, a handheld. So their ideal, and this is probably what Xbox is obviously working to with the cloud, but their ideal is, like, cloud-based games, like wireless, like, games that run that are... They don't want what Nintendo are doing, or certainly did, especially with the 3DS, where they're developing separate games, or, you know, the thing that Nintendo are holding back with the Switch is the fact that because of its size and form factor, that does reduce its power. It's not the optimum power necessarily Nintendo would aim for if they were developing purely a home console. Like, they are negating some of that power, surely, to get it so lean and slim and fit.
Yeah, like, exactly. When Switch came out in 2017, and I mean still to this day, it's kind of the same power level as a Wii U, which was the same power level as, like, a PS3, Xbox 360.
Right, exactly.
So they are on a power level still, like, two generations behind, but the trade-off was, hey, you can take it anywhere, and that's the choice they made.
So we're still in a world of trade-offs where my PlayStation 5 is much, much bigger than a Steam Deck. And there's a very good reason for that, because it's a lot more powerful. There is still a trade-off where if you are ignoring the cloud situation, which is kind of like where the companies are going, but there's a trade-off in how big the Steam Deck is versus how large that thing is compared to your PC, MBZ.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yes.
Like, there's a we are still, like, solid-state drives, keeping the things cool, keeping the things running, all these things, fans, like, mm-hmm. they're big, and they hard drives and other computer words, you know, like, big things, they still take up a lot of space. And so in that sense, we're not going to see handhelds, because I don't think Sony want to be making different versions or lowering the power of their games when they live in this world of, we need to make it 4K, we need to make it 8K. The word 8K is still on the PS5 box. Like, they are chasing they're chasing mainly P's, but they're also chasing a little bit frame rate. But I know we've gone back and forth on that bit. My point is that they want power, and if that is more important to them than ever putting out a handheld. Now, the thing that they're doing with the lightsaber down the middle, the controller, it's interesting because it is cloud-based. So it allows them to keep all their ducks in a row, in the sense that they don't have to change their development in any way. They are just streaming one device to another. And that's cool, because you can kind of play on the handheld, but equally you have to be near a PS5, or you just have to be within a wireless.
I'm actually not sure on the full details. I believe that it's like an in-home thing only, which I just, that feels like extremely limited. If it was a, hey, I'm at, you know, some other house and I want to remote into my PS5 and, like, I can turn it on remotely and play it through the internet of someone else's while it's still sitting at home, I think that might be a bit more interesting, and maybe that is the case for this device. But But it's still weird because, like, the types of people who would use this, someone like Greg Miller, right? Like, PlayStation diehard, someone who uses a phone and a backbone controller to stream PlayStation games already, like, what is the function of this that doesn't already achieve, right? Because if you are doing that, you already probably have stuff like that set up to go. So I guess the screen is bigger and it's a dedicated device.
It's a bigger device. It's got the official PlayStation 5 controller because it's been split down the middle by a lightsaber. Right. Like, so I guess there's some appeal. And I think the
Rumble stuff, which is nice, I guess. Like, you'll probably get all the DualSense Rumble, features from having that. So
I can see some things, but ultimately, in our view and the view of many hardcore gamers or people who play a lot of video games like us, like, cloud gaming isn't there. Like, I don't think there's an abundance of Greg Millers out there playing all these games on the cloud having a great time, especially when so many of the most popular games in the world are so action-based, whether it's COD or Fortnite or other shooters or Overwatch or whatever.
I guess we should distinguish, because this is technically not cloud-based. It's technically directly streaming from one device to another, which is somewhat different.
So you think latency will be reduced?
Potentially. Like, I streamed, I remember when I was playing Persona 5 back in 2017, I had my PS4 in one room and I went into my other room with the PC because the TV was being used, and I had a thing on my PC where I could open up a remote play window. It's basically remote play, essentially. It's a remote play window on my PC to play Persona 5, and there was still a lot of bitrate bullshit going on.
It was still
lagginess, and it was fine because it's a turn-based RPG, so it doesn't make as much a difference, But I think there's still problems with that setup. Maybe it's got a lot better because that was back in PS4, and so not as refined as it is today. But I think, like, there's a slight difference there in that what Microsoft is doing is cloud-based, which is, you know, just drawing from their own servers, their own stuff, whereas this is directly streaming in your own home from your device to another device. So,
and I think, like we've already said, all of them are trade-offs. Whether it's cloud-based, there's a slight delay, or whether it's direct streaming for a device, that's not really handheld in a traditional sense when you think about it. So, to answer the question directly, is this something Sony want to do? In a hypothetical world where power was no barrier, absolutely. Like, stuff like the Switch is obviously selling very well. The Steam Deck's doing fine for itself. I think the idea that Sony would have a dedicated handheld that they develop separate for, I think the days of that are gone. I think in 10, 15 years' time, when I do think there will be a much closer parity in the technology you can fit into a handheld versus the technology you can fit into a home console, because I don't think consoles are going to get smaller. I know they're going big right now, but eventually I think they might go smaller. I think that's when you'll see Sony be like, right, we've now got some level of parity, we should make another Vita or another PSP. But it does feel like the direction is more cloud-based. I'm interested if that eventually gets pulled off and latency gets worked out, or maybe latency doesn't get worked out but it still is successful regardless. Who knows? But, like, because of the trade-offs in the current situation, and no one wants to do a Nintendo, which is basically take your foot off the gas on power in order to preserve form size and form factor, like I was saying, Sony pride themselves on their first-party games being very beautiful, cinematic, highly powerful, power-driven games. Like, they're not going to be doing anything handheld for the foreseeable, for that reason, I think.
Yes. I'll come back to that point in a minute, actually.
Okay.
I think there's an interesting thing to jump off of that. What I was going to say is, like, that I think there is a likelihood that stuff like NVIDIA's DLSS, which is rumored to be in the Switch successor, is a way in the future for us to see even, like, the next Steam Deck or, like, other devices be able to come out and not have as higher specs but still achieve similar performance and visuals, because they're able to upscale stuff, right, by using that technology, which I think would be a game changer in some ways, because it would allow you to sell these devices at cheaper prices and not kind of break the bank, while also maintaining a bit more parity in terms of a power level.
Plus, you're ultimately going onto a smaller screen, whether that's 720p or 1080p. Like,
yes,
that's
exactly.
Still not 4K, so you can
right.
That's a That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah.
So we might be closer to that point than my hypothesis suggested, you're right.
Maybe, yeah. It depends on how it works. Like, it works really well on PC for me right now, you know? Like, I was playing Plague Tale at 120 frames when I wouldn't have been able to otherwise because it's a brand new game, very high fidelity and, like, all that sort of stuff. But with the LSS, I was able to kind of crank it all away by using that.
Oh,
so,
cool.
So, yeah, that definitely has a big impact. The point I want to come back to is... we know what Sony's future is going to be, given the way they're talking about it. And the types of games that they are planning to make right now, multiplayer, service, always online, guess what doesn't work with handhelds, where you're out the house, there's no Wi-Fi signal, you're on a plane, you're in a park. Those games are fundamentally incompatible with the internet infrastructure right now and the idea of having a dedicated handheld. Like, I think the Steam Deck is great for first-party Sony games right now because there are a lot of them on PC, and so you can play God of War handheld and all that sort of stuff. In a few years' time, the makeup of their studios is going to look quite different and is going to be mainly centered around games that require you to be connected to the internet constantly. And so the idea of putting out a dedicated handheld when your entire lineup from a studio perspective is based around always online games is kind of fundamentally against that idea.
You think it's going to be the entire studio library? They're not even going to like keep going, you know, with their current first party single player.
Oh, I think that stuff will happen. But like they've even said, like 60% of their resources are going towards that, right?
To the multiplayer stuff.
So
which
like,
is wild. Yeah,
we're gonna get, you know, Wolverine from Insomniac. We'll get another Naughty Dog game, whatever that is. It seems like Last of Us 3 from rumors and leaks. We're gonna get, you know, the stuff that we expect. Another Santa Monica AAA game, right? That stuff will happen. But again, those games take 5 to 6 years, and development cycles only getting longer and longer, and you know Sony have already announced a bunch of multiplayer stuff, and there's more to come, and it is going to start becoming a bigger part of their identity. And I to talk about this specifically, like why they wouldn't do a portable handheld, that's as good a reason as any, because it just doesn't make sense if so many of your resources are going towards those types of games. It's not the type of game that works on a portable system. Like, you can play them, but it's not ideal because the sticks are a bit weirder, and so the aiming is a bit off for shooters, that sort of thing. Like, there's a fundamental disadvantage that you have in a competitive space with it, but also, you just don't have the connectivity, and you can't go around and be connected all the time.
Again, if the trade-offs weren't there on that kind of stuff from a power perspective, they'd go for it.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's the thing. Like, we may eventually be in a place where, hey, internet is everywhere, and none of that becomes a problem anymore. And I don't know. It's probably still a few decades off from that even happening, but that would be the kind of scenario they'd have to be in order for that to work. I like my Vita a lot. I really like it. I think it's a great little system, and it has a great screen. Like the OLED screen on the Vita is great, just like the OLED screen is great on the Switch. OLED screens are amazing, and they make things look so much nicer and better. But again, it comes down to a software problem, right? Nintendo were really the only people who could pull off doing franchises on handheld and console and not really slow down. And them stepping away from that has massively benefited the Switch because there have been so many first-party games out of Nintendo.
They've sped up, it feels like.
Yeah, because they don't have to worry about splitting their audience anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Like, in the past, you'd have a new Super Mario Brothers game handheld and a new Super Mario Brothers game console. They're just making one new 2D Mario, and it works on both, right? So, like, that is a game that they don't have to make for a dedicated audience. Of course, yeah, but, you know, like, it has really removed some duplication. Like, did anyone really need to play New Super Mario Bros. 2? Really? No. Like, that game's fine, but it's just such a nothing video game. But they needed a 2D Mario on 3DS, so that's what they did. Mm. But they also needed one on Wii U, so they made a totally different one for Wii U. And, like, that sucks. Like, it's not a good problem to have, and solving it by having one device has just lent them so much benefit. I think Sony would want to do the same thing because they, as you can see from PSP and Vita, like, they try to support them, but then they're like, oh, this thing's not selling and we have to put out things for our big boy consoles, so they just forgot about it and they just left it behind. So having it all in one pipeline, it makes the most sense, and I think that's what's going to happen. But yeah, I mean, the day that Sony comes back with a handheld, they still have Nintendo to compete against, and now they have Valve as well. So it's going to be, I think it's a much trickier arena for them to enter into now, even than it was back then.
Yeah.
There you go.
Our next email is from Tim on Discord. Says, hey guys, I have a Tears of the Kingdom centric email for you today. I'm taking a break from Tears of the Kingdom right now while my right Joy-Con gets fixed, so I've had a chance to reflect a little on my time with the game so far, and I have one major problem with Tears of the Kingdom. Take this all with a pinch of salt, as I'm only around 80 hours in and two dungeons into the game, but the more I play, the stronger I feel that it is much worse than its predecessor Breath of the Wild in one key area, exploration. The reused Hyrule map definitely contributes to this, but I think there's a bigger problem. The magical feeling in Breath of the Wild of seeing something interesting off in the distance and figuring how to get there while finding eight other interesting things along the way just doesn't happen the same way in Tears of the Kingdom. If I see something in the distance in Tears of the Kingdom, the most efficient way to get there is to either sail down from a sky island, use a tower, or build a flying contraption. I find myself playing with much more like a classic open world game, jumping from mini-map icon to mini-map icon using pins. I've barely touched my horses. Maybe this is a me problem, but I'm reminded of the old quote, players will optimize the fun out of a game given the chance. I've covered the whole map, but barely feel like I've actually explored any of it. This type of traversal is harder in the depths, but there is the problem. I don't think the depths are interesting to explore at all. There's very little of interest to find beyond light routes and mines. And if you're exploring sky islands, you get old maps marking out the few points of interest for you. I love the sky islands, but don't feel like I'm exploring them so much as solving their puzzles. I'm definitely enjoying how I'm discovering everything the devs carefully placed in the game and the change to Hyrule from Breath of the Wild, but I no longer feel that I am exploring in the same way. And that's a real shame, as that's an aspect I truly love in video games. Curious to hear your thoughts about this. Obviously, Tears of the Kingdom is still a 10 out of 10 game of the year, but this one aspect has been the most disappointing for me. Thanks, as always, for a great show, Tim.
Oh, spicy. it's been really interesting, I think, seeing Tears of the Kingdom discourse, and like, on one hand you have people calling it the best game of all time, like you do with Breath of the Wild, and on the other hand you have a lot of kind of detractions for certain elements, and I feel like I'm falling somewhere in the middle of it. Like, there is like a lot of stuff in the game that I was wowed by and thought was tremendous, but there is a sense of fatigue of like, I found myself when I was exploring the map being like, oh, well, do I really have to go over this landmass? I did it in the last game. And like, is there really going to be that much difference? And as much as people say, oh, the map's very different, like, sure it is, like, topographically, but there isn't as much of a sense of like, this is totally brand new. And I think that's the fundamental problem, is I'm like, oh God, this entire beach area, like, I can walk this thing, but I've done it before, and I did it so thoroughly before, and it feels like because the game pushes you and encourages you to create contraptions to get places faster and to kind of work around elements, it does feel like, Tim said, like, I think when I did, so I have jumped back into Tears of the Kingdom after I rolled credits, and I was like, oh, let me just, because on my map I marked a bunch of shrines to go back to, so like, I saw them from the sky, marked them, and you know, I'm just trying to clean them up. And what I would do is I would go to the tower, fast travel there, and then just skydive to the shrine, do it, and fast travel back to the tower, yeah. Skydive to the next shrine. Yeah. And I'm like, this feels bad, but like, also, I don't feel like I would have really gained anything had I just walked there, because I did it already last time, right?
Yes.
And it's a really tough thing, because I think that's my issue with this game, at kind of a deep level, is I really wish it was a different world. It's just sucked a lot of the joy out of finding things out, because you didn't know what was around every corner, and because you kind of do. Like, maybe there's something slightly different, but that's very different than not knowing anything at all. And I think when I think about how Elden Ring hit me, like, it's the same as Breath of the Wild because it's completely unknown.
Yes.
And that's why that, I think, has a larger effect on me than this game has. Despite all of its incredible moments, I was literally, before we started recording, watching Andy Cortez's video of the end of Tears of the Kingdom, just to see his reaction to some moments, because, like, there's great moments, and the music and everything is awesome. But, you know, there are flaws, and I think it's good to kind of explore those, quote-unquote.
Yeah. I mean, I'm similar-ish to Tim in terms of amount of play, where I'm like 50 hours, two main dungeons, and I think the exploration is the worst part of this game. And for the from what I've played so far, and from what Tim has said, from what you've said, MBZ, yeah, like Breath of the Wild is, it's, we've talked about it before, where it's the Magic Kingdom comparison, like the station at the front of Magic Kingdom is blocking your view of Cinderella Castle for the very reason that they want you to see Cinderella Castle when you walk through the gate. Like, that's the reveal, that's the sense of exploration. And like Mark Brown did a very good video about Breath of the Wild just before Tears of the Kingdom came out, and it's about the way that the developers designed the entire world around triangles. And it's this, the triangles are that Magic Kingdom logic. Triangles, large triangles, small triangles, are blocking out other triangles in the distance. So the point is that, like, mountains are blocking points of interest from other points in the map. So when you get to the top of a mountain, it reveals another mountain, and then you can't actually see the mountain behind that mountain until you're on top of the other mountain. So there's that sense of exploration and discovery, and that feeling in Breath of the Wild is one of its strengths, and why it feels like there's a real synergy between exploration, the world design, shrine hopping, that all that stuff feels far more synergistic than what I've done so far in Tears of the Kingdom. Now, Tears of the Kingdom might still be a better game than Breath of the Wild. I don't want to make that call yet. I need to beat the game. I'm intrigued by all the other stuff. But it's undeniable that, like, for me, that exploration is reserved for aspects of the depths, and it's very, that's a very different style of exploration to Mark Brown's video talking about the way that Breath of the Wild, and you explore that map through revealing triangles, essentially, and revealing things, because that sense of revealing things is happening in very different ways. And I've had that feeling, MBZ, exactly when I was in the area just before the Rito village, where I'm walking through this valley that I've walked through before, and there's a couple of shrines, and there's some other interesting stuff that is in different places, but that's not grabbing me in the same way as how I felt when I walked through that valley in Breath of the Wild. And it is a real shame that they chose a different part of map, and sorry that they didn't do a new map for this game. And yeah, it's a weird one, because all the other mechanics and weapon building and crafting, and it actually makes the game overall, when you relate it to the world, it's actually a less synergistic game than Breath of the Wild. It's less elegant.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
And that's not to say that it's a worse game, but, you know, like, it, that impact and the elegance of Breath of the Wild, and the way that you care about the villages, because you just discovered that village today because it was behind a mountain you hadn't seen yet. You don't get that in Tears of the Kingdom. And there's those points of magic that are like, wow. And, you know, Elden Ring is a much flatter map than like a Breath of the Wild, but it still reveals things in its own way. It is doing stuff with triangles in its own way. It's just not using it through mountains and things. It's other ways. And
yes, like elevators and like getting up to
new
areas. From like the way that Liurnia is revealed after you do Stormveil Castle, right? Like the framing of that space.
Totally, totally. That's a great example. That is train station front of Magic Kingdom 101. Like, we want to reveal Cinderella's castle.
Yep.
You have to walk through this thing first. And like, that's really, really impressive. And yeah, was exploration the best part of Breath of the Wild? I think it's hard to define it in and of itself, because like Tim described, and like we described when we played Breath of the Wild, our favorite points were, I see that shrine on that hill, I'll go to that shrine, I'll do the shrine, but now I've just discovered there's this mountain beyond the thing, and oh my god, there's a town down there. So you're playing the game while exploring, and it all synergizes together. So trying to separate exploration as its own specific thing is much harder to do in Breath of the Wild.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's quite easy to do in Tears of the Kingdom, arguably, because you can just say, it's basically all you're doing in the depths is exploring. It's very focused on that. It's less that point to point, to doing a thing, to doing a shrine, because there aren't shrines in the depths. Like, it's just a bit different.
Right.
So yeah, I'm the jury's out for me with Tears of the Kingdom. I'm still absolutely loving all the new stuff, but it's an incredibly different game in so many aspects to Breath of the Wild, and I think Tim's nailed it. The exploration is a really big part of that, and it's a shame that that aspect is less impactful, but I'm intrigued to see if other more impactful parts of the game will make it higher in my mind, the Breath of the Wild, or not, and I'm not there yet. I don't know.
Yeah, I think inherently exploration is also tied to discovery, and discovery comes in a lot of different ways, and I think part of the discovery of Breath of the Wild was everything about this is fundamentally different, right? For a Zelda game, for the systems they had, like the physics interactions, the chemical interactions, the fact that, you know, your lightning thing would in a rainstorm start sparking, and if you had metal and you'd be like, what? And like, those things are still here, but when it happens, now it's familiar. Maybe it depends on your point of view, but yeah. I think my problem is it's familiar. And so by its nature, familiarity lacks surprise and discovery. And so when in this game, you know, that happens, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that. That's cool. And it doesn't, and I register and I'm like, I like that from the first game, but it's not a new thing here. And that happens so frequently and so often with things that, because they're essentially taking everything that worked in the previous game and keeping it, it's basically layering butter on bread, right? Like, bread is the thing, or toast, right? They made this bread, so much work to create it, put it all together. Tears of the Kingdom is like, how do we make this really tasty? A lot of butter all over the top, right? And that's, for me, what it feels like, because there's a core, heavy, you know, scrumptious thing, but we're adding some taste on top of it, and it's a very thin layer. And I don't want to say that Tears of the Kingdom is like, you know, DLC or a knockoff or whatever, but with like a little bit. But because of just the magnitude of changes that Breath of the Wild brought, there's lots of stuff Tears of the Kingdom does, but it just can't match the magnitude of the change in the first place. And so I think that contributes to this feeling as well, where we are seeing things that we have already seen, and we are doing things we have already done. Hell, there are quests in this game that are just like kind of the same as the previous game, where it's like, oh, there's a big horse. Okay, you're going to do that again now. I get it. And I think that, but part of my frustration with this is like people who are playing this and talking about things as if they were new in this game, when clearly they weren't. Like, they were in Breath of the Wild, but seemingly everyone is like, universally forgot, and I don't know why that's happened, but I see it happen a lot. And I don't know, maybe it's just because I have such vivid and strong memories tied to my entire experience of Breath of the Wild, and I finished Tears of the Kingdom 2-3 months ago, and there are things that I remember, but because it's the same world again, like, I don't have that first time impression that leaves me with that remembrance in my brain of like, oh, I did that, and that's where I enjoyed my time and had my fun there. And I think ultimately, like, the exploration that I enjoyed the most was down in the depths. The problem with the depths is that after you spend like a good 7 to 10 hours there, you realize it's just kind of all the same. There's not a lot of variety there. A lot of the surprise and discovery was like the first time seeing stuff, but the problem is it's not as surprising as the first time Breath of the Wild's overworld was being explored, because there's so many more factors going on there versus underground, where it's like there are kind of three fundamental like core material things you get, like bombs, muddle buds, and the I can't remember the other one, but like the third thing, and then like you have enemy encampments and some big bosses. They're like a big toad boss, and then like some other kind of corrupted bosses, but a lot of them are the same. There's a duplicativeness to it. Like, obviously it's in inverting the world and everything, but I just eventually I was like, I'm just kind of running right light route to light route, and there's no real reason for me to meander in between these places. Like, I might as well get a big truck and just drive to the next one, because I'm not going to miss anything. I'm just going to go past another enemy encampment, which just has a lot of resources in it, and it feels like to that point it becomes kind of a resource grind of, well, if I need to build stuff, I need to get zonite from down here that I just collect a ton of, and that's the useful part of being down there. But the actual discovery and exploration of that space, after a point, once the kind of novelty of it wears off, it's like, yeah, I'm just kind of doing the same stuff. And the sky is a similar thing where the sky is just far less populated than I wanted it to be. And a lot of those islands feel like there's not a lot on them. There's kind of a lack of reward, I would say, for exploring the space. And I think all this compounds, basically, right? Because you don't have that big hit, that impact of, look at all this new stuff. Once you start to find things, you know, being repeated, it wears on you a bit more, I think. And so I think that's why it kind of doesn't stick in the memory as clearly. But I also think Tears of the Kingdom is a game where, like, fundamentally, you need to be the type of person who wants to engage with its systems at a deep level. And if you don't want to build stuff and get weird and wacky and creative and kind of Minecrafty with it, I don't think you're going to get the full experience out of it. Like, you have to be willing to meet it where it is with that. And if you just kind of ignore it and, like, just kind of make that build the same thing again and again, you're not going to have that fun experience. And I think that was part of the thing with combat in Breath of the Wild, where a lot of people were like, oh, well, I just use my sword. I'm like, well, yeah, because you're not approaching combat in an interesting way. You're not using the systems that the game is providing you. And I think the most fun I have had is when I have decided I'm going to make something really stupid. And, like, that sticks in my memory because I'm like, I remember that really stupid thing that happened, and that created a story, a player story in my mind of that time I did that thing and it fucked up. Like, the entire balloon story that I talked about on this show back when the game first came out, like, I remember that really clearly because it was me trying to meet the game where it was with its systems and pushing against them and just trying to be weird with it. And I think if I do jump back into Tears of the Kingdom, it will be far more focused on the things that it does well, which is just taking a bunch of shit and putting it together and seeing if you can make a weird vehicle and seeing what you can do with that. And, like, the things that there's a really good Reddit I recommend people check out. I think it's called Hyrule Engineering, r/Hyrule Engineering. Fantastic Reddit. You go there and the things people are making are fucking mind-blowing. They are absolutely insane. And that's the kind of joy of kind of discovery, is like how these things integrate with each other. Someone made, like, a remote flying drone that they controlled with a stick from the ground using the electricity things, because the electricity line runs through the air to this thing that flies in the sky. And so someone's on the ground with a stick literally controlling this fucking flying thing. I'm like, I had no idea that the physics, the sandbox, allowed for this to exist, but it does. And I think that's really where this game shines. And I think it's the thing that if I was to have approached it more in that way, maybe it would have stuck with me a little bit more. But that's the thing I want to do myself, is jump back in and just sit down and just make a bunch of shit and see what happens. Because I think that's where it excels, essentially. So
yeah, I'd say my highs so far in Tears of the Kingdom are, I've really enjoyed just, like, going to the town, speaking to the people, and understanding, like, the traditional Zelda thing of, what's the problem in this area? How do I clear your dungeon and solve your problem and move on? And I've gotten a lot of satisfaction from that, and that's one aspect that's very much stronger than Breath of the Wild so far for me. We've already talked about the side quests. I think are really strong so far, that the ones I've done, and yeah, the sky is a little bit limited, but I've still really enjoyed those puzzles, and especially any contraption to do with flight, and, like, your story about the balloon. I had my story about, like, reaching the labyrinth in the sky, and just, like, that stuff is really, really cool. But again, it's cool. It's a separate thing to the discussion of that exploration discovery loop of Breath of the Wild. It's a very different game to that, even though it's obviously the same world. But, like, yeah, I just need a lot more time played in the game, and I've got a lot more of the depths to try and get my head around, and I'm still on that, like, building up my power, trying to identify, like, little goals, little things to improve my power. I've got a whole thing to do in the what do you call the forest?
The lost woods,
right? Yeah. I've still got, like, stuff to do there that I've unlocked, but I know what I need to do next, and, like, it's like, what does that lead to? Okay, well, I need to try that. And so, yeah, I'm still really absolutely loving it. And but for me, you know, I need more of it, and then I need a good long think and try and memorize how did I feel about Breath of the Wild. And maybe it is an advantage coming out with such a cool looking system like the Switch. I don't know, it's just it's going to be very tricky to compare the two, because they are, while they're very similar in some ways, I think the strengths of each game are so different, and that will be a very interesting discussion, I'm sure, for episode 200 and, well, be episode 300, I guess, where they will eventually go head to head. But
I feel like I always come out of these conversations being like, oh god, I feel like I just ragged on this game that everyone is critically praising constantly. And here's the thing, like, there are moments in Tears of the Kingdom that are like jaw-dropping shit, right? Like, there is a sequence that I did where I found a thing, I was like, this is majestic and insane, and it's like maybe one of my favorite things in a game that I've done, where narrative and like gameplay came together, and I was like, I figured this out, this is happening right now, what the fuck, what the fuck, what the fuck, right? Like, there's stuff like that that is still in here.
I'll definitely say, like, as much as exploration is better in Breath of the Wild, exploration is a huge part of Breath of the Wild. I don't think exploration is necessarily a big part of Tears of the Kingdom, and the list of awesome things that are more interesting than exploration in Tears of the Kingdom, many of those are basically non-existent in Breath of the Wild. So, like, just because exploration is better in Breath of the Wild doesn't mean that it's the better game. It's just one aspect of two very different games.
Yeah, I think that Breath of the Wild is a more coherent vision from the ground up, every aspect considered to be in harmony with one another. And I think Tears of the Kingdom fundamentally can't be that, because it's building on a harmony and adding stuff on top of it. And so it creates this disjointed feel, in a sense.
Yeah, massively.
But it still has a lot of really interesting and unique stuff going on. So, yeah, it's definitely tricky. And, you know, like, we're going to talk about both of these games for as long as we live, probably, just because the impact that they are having. And I think that they're always interesting conversations. And there'll be a lot to come in the years of people revisiting them and thinking about them and discussing them. So it's just tip of the iceberg here. So
we'll get there. What if we fall on different sides?
Yeah, God, that makes it really hard, that makes it very tricky. We shall see. Well, that is going to close us out for today's show. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. You can do lots of stuff with us, like follow us on Twitter. It's called Twitter, and I will brook no other discussion. Bally, where can they find you on Twitter.com?
I'm on Twitter at Ballyman91. That's BallyMan91.
You can find me at LordNBZ, and you can follow the podcast at TNL Podcast, where we tell you about what's happening on the show. You can find links to our Discord there, where we got some of these emails from. Also, our YouTube channel, where you can go and have it on in another tab, if you so wish, as opposed to going onto a podcast app to find us. But if you do want to go onto a podcast app to find us, you can do that, and you can find us on Spotify, on Stitcher, various other places on the internet. Download us, subscribe, all that good stuff. And if you want to go that extra step further, that extra little mile, you can go to patreon.com/thisNintendoLife, where you can support the show directly and get bonus episodes and fun stuff. Bally, we'd like to thank some of our patrons.
Yes, thank you to our $10 plus patrons. They are Zach S, Thomas, Matthew, Albert, Wicked Gamer UK, Alan, and Turtle. Thank you all for your support. But thank you to all of our other patrons. We really, really, really appreciate the support you give the show. It makes a huge difference, and, you know, keeps the costs of video games down a bit, because, you know, me and MBZ, we like to buy a lot of video games, so we really, really appreciate that.
Absolutely. So yeah, go over there, check out the stuff if you so wish, and that'll be all good. And also, reminder that if you want to check out that show I guested on, that episode of Infendo Radio, I'll have that linked in the description as well. So give those guys a listen, check them out, they're cool people over there. I think that is going to do us for now, Bally. We're getting close to a bit of a lull in the releases.
Have some space to beat these gargantuan games I'm playing.
Yeah, I might actually put a few more hours into Octopath Traveler 2. That'll be good. Is Wonder like the next big thing on the horizon? I think from a Nintendo perspective, there's probably some other stuff in there in the middle.
I'm sure there's some indies maybe, but I think the next game I will play on Switch once I defeat all the defeat.
Once you
like
beat Ganondorf, the man.
Once I defeat Ganondorf, will probably be Super Mario Brothers Wonder.
Yes. So very excited for that. But that'll be a little while away. Until then, thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back at you in a couple of weeks' time with some more of this. See you then. Bye, folks. The musical interlude used on today's show was Olimar's Shipwreck Tale from Pikmin 4, copyright Nintendo 2023.